1, 1743. Added the following information about the events of the day. This is the day this denomination was formed and the reason for choosing the name. The Reverend Mr. John McMillan and the Reverend Mr. Thomas Nairn, with their respective elders, did, by solemn prayer, constitute themselves into a presbytery, immediately under Christ their head, under the name of the Reformed Presbytery, by which title they understood a presbytery professing to adhere and bear testimony to our covenanted Reformation as it was carried on in the nation betwixt the years 1638 and 1649. They later explained that they chose this name because it was, quote, their honest intention faithfully to adhere to the whole of our Reformation attainments in both church and state, without knowingly dropping any of these. On this account, it is presumed they may justly enough be called the Reformed or Reformation Presbytery. Now, when we first moved in here, I wanted the church to be known as the Reformation Presbyterian Church. And at one point, the letterhead and even my signature, the part at the bottom of it, spelled it out, the Reformation Presbyterian Church. People say, where did this church come from? When I go out to Plainfield, kids say, what church, and to work with them out there some, the kids say, what church do you belong to? I said, I'm in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And they don't hear the ED. They just hear, I'm in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. They say, oh, you know about us. You have a whole church of us back there in Indianapolis. People from Reform. Well, then I have to spell it out. And it's easier to do it. We always nickname everything when it jumps the pond here, the Atlantic. And so instead of spelling it out to be the Reformation Presbyterian Church, we call it Reformed. And when we do that, we miss something. We miss the very thing that these two quotations have just told you about. In the light of the earlier research into relationships between the exercise and the presbytery during these particular years, the claim to be the Reformation Presbytery should have involved some attachments to the exercise meetings. And further research reveals that such a relationship was an extraordinary feature of the life of this particular denomination from the date of her constitution, from the date of her constitution. What was that date? August what? 1743. From the date of her constitution for over 100 years, these exercise meetings were a very important factor in the life of a growing church. I'm tempted to say that the minute they began slighting the exercise meetings, they stopped growing. There were other factors involved. It wasn't as simple as that. The fellowship societies were an interesting Scottish development of the exercise, the societies now. I'm not calling them exercise so much as I am societies, spelled with a capital S. Societies in those words had a little different meaning, that word had. They may have had an existence, these societies, dating back to the earliest days of Lollard Christianity in Scotland. Who were the Lollards?
Followers of Luther.
Followers of Luther and down in England.
Wycliffe.
Lollards. The Lollards, you remember, had a lot of influence in Scotland, and these meetings may have dated clear back to them, but it would appear that they became defined and visible as an influence at the time of the Reformation, and more precisely, an even greater influence between the restoration of Charles II and the Revolution Settlement of 1689. Richard Cameron and James Rennick had been very actively involved in assisting with the organization of these societies on the national level. Not long after he was killed, they began, that is after Cameron was killed, they began to function in a practical, visible form. On December 15, 1681, these societies held their first general or national meeting, claiming to be, and this is very important, neither civil nor ecclesiastic judicatories. Now, what's that mean? They were meeting, but they claimed to be neither civil nor ecclesiastic judicatories, using the words they used. What would that mean? They were not... What? They were not a civil government. They were not a nation within a nation, nor ecclesiastic judicatories. What would that mean? They were not a church. They were not a state. And they were not a church. They insisted from the very beginning they were not a state and they were not a church, but of the same nature with particular Christian societies in the time of this extreme persecution gathered together in their general correspondence. Now, watch these words. They can be tricky and trick you, trap you. Correspondence. Are you ever writing letters with someone and he writes and you write and he writes back and forth? That's a correspondence. So when you spell out with a capital C, it means there's a constant communication. You guys on email have a correspondence. And they call this the general correspondence. These societies were gathered together and organized. That's what Cameron was doing, and that's what Rennick was doing, and Cargill was involved in these. These were being organized all over Southwest Scotland for our preservation and the propagation of our testimony according to the Word of God, the law of nature, the fundamental constitutions and laudable practices of our ancient covenanted church and nation, acting jointly and harmoniously by way of consultation, deliberation, and admonitory determination. They have a way of just adding and adding and adding and adding. But what they're saying is here are all these different societies all over, especially southwestern Scotland, but they were also in the north. I just don't think we know very much about how they were meeting in the north. But I find more and more evidence of them all over Scotland, but especially in the south and the west, areas where we'll be. And they were just meeting all over as men got together and read the word and they met with their neighbors and others and then they would compare notes with the other societies around them. And now they're saying we need more organization than this. We need a more consistent communication among each other. I think I'm going to turn that telephone off some of these times. That's the second time someone bumped her head on that thing. But we need to communicate better with each other than what we're doing. It was a period of bitterest persecution. Thousands of men, women, and children were being killed. The church was going underground. In spite of the persecution, maybe because of it, all over Scotland, men who could read the Bible sought out their neighbors. And if they could read, they became leaders in a local fellowship society. In those home Bible studies, they dealt with matters of life and death. Did the scriptures order them to pay the cess? That was the tax on produce. They took their grocery, whatever it was they were growing in their farms. They took it into the village or the city of Edinburgh to sell, and there was always a tax on it. And that tax went towards persecuting them. And should they attend the king's communion services? The king ordered people to come to the parish church for communion. If you didn't show up, then you were declared fugitive and your lands were declared forfeit. It was a test of loyalty to King Charles or King James. It was not a proof of loyalty to King Christ. It was a political expedient, the communion itself. So should they go or should they not go? What should be their attitude towards things like this? Should they hear the Bible-teaching fugitive ministers at the outlawed conventicles? If they went to those conventicles, later on under Charles II and James, whatever he was, the second or the seventh, if they went to those, The king had said, don't do it. If you do, you'll be killed. Should they do it? I mean, it wasn't just a case of whether we obey the law or not. It's a case of I'm the breadwinner in the family. If I get shot, then what am my family going to do? So these were agonizing questions. They weren't just playing games. It was life and death matters. Should they obey the king or their conscience? Should they respond possessed passively to the killings or with armed resistance? Did they have the right to bear arms? Rennick said when he died on the scaffold there in the grass market in Edinburgh that one of the three reasons why he was dying there that day was for the right to bear arms. Now in Britain today, no man's allowed to bear arms. Some gentlemen farmers and the nobility can have guns, but other people just aren't allowed to have any. I don't mean just handguns. I mean no guns, no long guns. And what rights did the people have to evaluate the rights of a civil ruler to rule or to replace him with someone else if he is not ruling according to the way God said that he was to rule? And seventh, what standards of character had God prescribed for men in offices of the church or the state? And eighth, did the state authorize the church, or did the church authorize the state, or did both receive equal authorization from Christ? And what did he say about the relationship? What did Christ say about the relationships between church and state? And ninth, in what sense was Christ still Lord in their beloved land? What were the crown rights and royal prerogatives of King Jesus? That was the tenth one. And how could they be related to the orders of a King James or a King Charles? The prerogatives of King Jesus, the orders of a King James. 11th, all aspects of personal, family, church, and state life were studied and dealt with in most basic practical levels. Drinking, profanity, faithfulness in family relationships. These were the kind of things that were coming up in these society meetings. Theory was out. Their lives, their lands, their families, their spiritual welfares were at stake. Various societies would send representatives to other meetings, develop a correspondence with them, held in the shire or the county. All the societies in a given, they call them shires over there, look out for that word. Dumfries Shire is the county around Dumfries. And it's a county, though. And so all the societies in a given county would begin comparing notes, we'd say, to encourage each other in these things. From December of 1681, they met on a national level as a general correspondence of United Societies. The minutes or the results of those studies were carefully written up in the form of the conclusions. And that's a book today. The conclusions of the United Societies of Southwest Scotland. And circulated among the correspondences and local societies. I think it was sometimes I see the word 10 days, but I think it was every 14 days. In other words, here were these individual groups. They were meeting, and then they would compare notes at the shire or county level, and then they would send their results up to the Loch Goyne, where John Howie's home was. And that's one of the places we're going to see. I insisted that we see that. Because there, all these conclusions were sort of synthesized and worked together and then sent back down. And you could see what encouragement that would be. Yeah, this is important enough to die for. Other families are dying. Somebody died last week. Somebody else died this week. And they weren't spread out and split up, isolated, alone, and lonely. But they were really encouraged by learning what others were doing and what the application was and what it was costing them. At the end of the killing times, the revolution settlement in 1689, granted many of the things for which the societies have been contending. First, the right of the people to judge the rights of a monarch to rule. Yeah, Cameron and Rennick and some of the others have said that man is just not qualified to rule. And we're declaring war. As a matter of fact, they excommunicated him. They cut him off. Second, a kind of civil and religious liberty. That was won in the Revolution Settlement. Third, a Presbyterian form of government. That was won in that Revolution Settlement. But in the opinion of thousands of those most closely related to the societies, there were several other things that had not been accomplished. The personnel of church and state still were not possessed of the proper scriptural qualifications. They saw, as they said, sitting in the civil courts and also in the General Assembly of the church, men whose hands were red and reeking with the blood of martyrs. They've been accepted in that revolution state and in that General Assembly after the revolution. They'd been accepted without ever confessing sin. They were accepted. And those who protested their presence there were rejected. Second, the constitutions of both church and state were not consistent with the early attainments of the Reformation, as summarized in the covenants. The covenants were ignored. They were just thrown out. You have to remember that there was a time there in the churchyard with Alexander Henderson and the others when if you were loyal to Jesus Christ, you would sign that covenant. Then came the time when the state said, if you sign that covenant, you have to renounce that, condemn that. And then it came back to the time when the covenants were authorized again. And Parliament was taking actions back and forth that were just exactly contradictory. And so where were the covenants going to be now at the time of the Revolution Settlement? Well, they were just ignored. They weren't endorsed. They weren't renewed. They were just ignored. Third, the settlement had been Erastian, something permitted by the state. And what these society people were saying, wait a minute. If the state authorizes the church, then what the state authorizes and establishes, she can one day disestablish. So that's not right. All the ordained ministers joined in the settlement. All the ordained ministers joined in the settlement. And so the society folk, these people meeting these societies, were left alone. From 1689 to 1786, how many years? Who can do that math quickly? 1689 to 1706, how many years is that? 1706. How many years is that? 17 years. Unknown thousands of people existed outside the organized church without marriages. Suppose you had been engaged, or within some time of those 17 years, you wanted to marry. There are lots of ministers around who've been happy to do it. But these people had convictions. They said, if those men have gone into that Revolution Settlement church, we will not marry. We'll wait until there's someone who can. Baptisms. Children born, not baptized. Any of the services an ordained minister had to perform, these men and women, thousands of them in Southwest Scotland. But in 1706, Reverend John McMillan joined them. And his reasons for joining them were almost identical for their reasons to their reasons for not going into that church. You should see John McMillan's baptismal record and his marriage record, his book. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of marriages and baptisms all over Scotland, the Southwest Scotland. It's an amazing record. And for 37 years, he was their only ordained minister, traveling the length and breadth of southern Scotland, marrying, baptizing, preaching the word to people who continue to insist that they were not the church, and they were merely waiting until the defections be condemned, at which time the Church of Scotland would rejoin them. In 1743, the Reverend Thomas Nairn also joined them. And then they were duly constituted, as I've shown you before in those statements of constitution, as the Reformation Presbyterian Church. Amazing fact is that for 54 years, from 1689 to 1743, the meetings of the United Societies, with a very minimum of clerical help, had held together thousands of Christians, and people still are guessing how many they were. I don't think that any of the estimates that I've seen are sufficient. I'll tell you why a little bit later on. And they developed a powerful testimony for Christ's crown and covenant. Some idea of their numbers of strength can be seen in the rate of the growth of the new church, Reformation Presbyterian Church. From one presbytery made up of one congregation, they said we'll just be one congregation, and just the two ministers who formed them, in 1743, they soon became a synod with six presbyteries, 43 congregations, and 36 ministers by the year 1863. The progress of world history may well have gone beyond the point where a small group of mature Christians can experiment in a pilot plant situation with the fundamental problems of church and state. Beecher and Calvin did it in the city-states of Strasbourg and Geneva. The United Societies did it, Southwest Scotland, 200 years later. But if the Reformation Church is to continue reforming, she must find the environment, the kind of a meeting, in which men and women who are not exegetes or historians or statesmen or philosophers or even pastors can discuss the current problems and opportunities of life with the help of these other men in the light of Scripture and the experiences of history and hammer out their conclusions. What God will have us to do and to be. And these conclusions must be so closely related to their convictions that they would be willing, if necessary, to die for them. That kind of a study will continue to be a very important factor in building, bridging the gap between history and theology, between organizational testimony and personal profession and practice, between political and moral truth. And it will continue to be an essential requirement for the continuing development and expansion of the testimony of any Reformation church that does exist. What Knox and the other reformers had found to be true of the type of exercise meeting in the 15th century, the United Societies found to be true in the 17th century. And the same results continued to be seen in the Reformation Presbyterian Church down into the 19th and 20th centuries. Now, I'm going to skip to the very end of what I have to say here this evening on this subject. I'm just going to have to talk, and maybe Heather can find the place where I'm talking from. I'm talking from memory now. I'm remembering a church of over 1,000 members, Reformed Presbyterian Church, Great Hamilton Street Church of Glasgow, Scotland, where there were 24 of these societies. For a long time, these societies chose representatives, 24 different societies within this one congregation, and they chose representatives who would then go to the congregational meeting and make the decisions for the whole congregation. These societies in the congregation elected the elders, not only admitted people to membership, and provided the delegates who would make the decisions at the annual meeting, but they also admitted people to membership and elected the elders. And I'm hoping I can find the place here where I can quickly summarize for you the results of that. Now, we're talking about a church that was in existence. After the Industrial Revolution. In other words, it becomes realistic for us to think about this as being a possibility in our own churches today here. Because this is after the Industrial Revolution. The fellowship meetings in this church were admirable schools. One of the men in the church is writing, he's describing it. The fellowship meetings in this church there in Glasgow were admirable schools for training young men to study and discriminate regarding divine truth. The exercises seemed to have been similar to those of fellowship meetings yet. The members in turn conducted the service. Each began with singing a psalm, reading the scripture, and prayer. A text or subject previously appointed was then discussed by all present. The chairman made some concluding remarks. The meeting was closed by singing a psalm and by prayer. There was the discussion in there in the application. One historian of that congregation names 30 ministers, 3 missionaries, including John G. Payton, 3 seminary professors, the editor of a church paper, a Christian publisher of national importance, the treasurer of a synod, and the architect of a synod. Traces these kinds of men back to those exercise meetings in that one congregation. Men went out from there to Ireland, England, America, Australia, the South Sea Islands during the first half of the 19th century. All I'm saying as I give you that brief summary there is that this kind of meeting can take place in the church as we know it today. Now, I want to, two things. I want to have a report on Donald Cargill and a report on Ulrich Zwingli. And then I want you to hear some more from Beth's tape. That's going to, I think, take up the remainder of this evening. So I don't know whether we can afford a break this evening or not. Let's call for the report on Donald Cargill. Could you come up right away on that? James, could you come on up on that, please? Mark, could you help me with these, please? Just go right ahead, James. There's...
Well, I guess I'd be the second speaker, which gives me not more than a half an hour, right? No, seriously, how long do I have?
Not more than 10.
Okay. Well, I assume everyone has a paper. Donald Cargill would later become known as the Elijah of his day. His birth date is actually under some debate. Some places, actually most places you'll see, say that he was born around 1610, but the most conclusive research that I saw said in 27 he was born. And there's another reason that I would possibly tend to believe 27 more. than 1610 is that in his later years, as he was being chased by the Dragoons, and that would have been in the late 70s or early 80s, he, legend has it, went running down one bank and leaped over a great chasm as the Dragoons were chasing, and the Dragoons got to the bottom and they realized they couldn't make that leap, and so they just had to turn around and walk back. And I don't know about you, but I'd take my chances of being able to do that at 50-some years old over being 70-some years old any day. So that's another reason that just made me think that 27 seemed like a more realistic date. But he was born into a Christian family and a highly educated family at that. His father sent him to school and really desired that he would walk with God from an early age, which he did. But he had a real lack of sense of security of his place in the Lord. And after he finished his college days, he underwent really a great spiritual crisis and was really doubting his salvation, was ready to commit suicide at the edge of an abandoned coal mine. And just as he stood poised on the brink, this is Maurice Grant in his book, he says, he stood poised on the brink, and then just as he prepared for the final leap, there came to him a voice, clear and unmistakable, "Son, be of good cheer, thy sins are forgiven thee." And later on, Cargill would say that for 30 years he'd been at peace with God and was never shaken from that assurance. And it was that assurance that gave him the ability to preach the word of God with such boldness and remain so true to the covenant, because he knew that his place in Christ was so secure. Soon after that, he was called into the ministry by the Lord through, what was the verse? It was the verse in Jeremiah, chapter 3, verse 1, God says, "Son of man, eat this roll and go and speak unto the house of Israel." And that was the verse that God used to draw him into the ministry. And at first he resisted it, but when he realized that it was God's call, he knew that there was no way in the world that he could run from that call and be able to continue to live. Then he went and studied. He studied under Samuel Rutherford, and we begin to see the Paul-Timothy relationship in Cargill's life. I'm not sure who that person was in Rutherford's life, but we see that it all kind of started with Martin Luther, who had something to do with the life of Martin Bietzer, who had something to do in the life of John Calvin, who had something to do with the life and development of John Knox. And Knox and Rutherford then were separated by a period of roughly 70 years or so, 50, 70 years. And so I'm just sure that there had to be somewhere in there some sort of relationship between Knox and Rutherford because of their place geographically and in history. And I haven't found those two people yet. And I've been looking and just learned about a new book about Samuel Rutherford that came out. And I'm excited to see that book and begin to see a little bit of the kind of people who had that sort of influence in Samuel Rutherford's life and see how that would have been traced back to John Knox. But I'm just confident that relationship is there. When he was finished with his seminary training in 1652 or 53, somewhere in there, the dates are a little bit sketchy on some of these things, he was caught between the protesters and the resolutioners in his call to the ministry and where he would go. There was really quite a fight between the presbyteries and peoples in the presbyteries, but he was a strong protester and was eventually ordained as the barony of Glasgow, where he ministered for 5 years and really had quite a time of ministry. He was married in that time. His wife died 4 months later. He underwent a number of other great hardships during that time personally, even though the land was much at peace, and he had a good ministry in the church. He just underwent a lot of personal problems that really helped to develop him so that in those later years of turmoil, he was very much prepared to handle those. One thing I would like to correct on page 4, the third paragraph, shortly after that time, it was 1660, that the king came back, and then in 62, the indulgences began where they would basically offer to allow the preachers to come back in and give them some leeway, but the king was still strongly in control. Many of the ministers took those indulgences, and I have that Cameron, McWard, and Cargill were in the minority in attacking the indulgences and those ministers who had accepted them. Many of the other ministers who were faithful did attack the indulgences, but they didn't separate fellowship with the ministers, which is what Cargill and these others were so known for. That's just a point of clarification. There were quite a few who did condemn the indulgences, but just refused to break fellowship with the ministers, and I didn't mean to have that sentence imply what maybe it did. But at any rate, the group was very small that stood up against the indulgences. They realized that King Jesus would be the only king over the church, and that no earthly king would, and they would not have any part of an earthly kingdom, of an earthly king over the church. And so they stood, and then the Covenanters were defeated at Bothwell Bridge in 79, and there was really a split among the ministers, those who wanted to condemn the indulgences more strongly and those who wanted to kind of grant some concessions. And Cargill and Cameron were really the only ones left. They went to Holland for a brief stay and then came back in May of 1680. And that's where their most intense time of preaching began. They were one of, I think there were three left at that point, but Cameron and Cargill were the two that were most noted. And they were very faithful. McPheeters, who has an excellent book called Sketches of the Covenanters, says that while a lot of people were very critical of Cameron and Cargill for the hardline stance that they took, he points out that Cameron and Cargill, with the society people, stood on a basis separated from their brethren who had stepped off the basis and left them alone to struggle against mighty odds and fierce enemies for the covenanted Reformation, to which all of them were bound by solemn oath. These worthies stood on the heights from which others had departed, and waving the old battle-worn colors of the covenant, appealed unto them to come up and occupy the ground where they had formerly stood. And he just points out that people were critical of him, but the fact of the matter is others had just left, and they were just standing firm. They hadn't picked out any new fights. They were just standing firm. You're familiar from the lectures with the Sanquhar Declaration and the Queensferry paper, for which they got into so much trouble. It's not clear, really, how much of a role Cargill played in those, although he did have something of a role. And finally, later that year, Cameron was killed, and for 1 year, Cargill was the only preacher. And he kept up a torrid pace of preaching all over the place, all over the countryside, had a great many communions and baptisms, and was very busy as the only minister. He excommunicated the king, which it seems to me should have probably been done long before that, in September of 1680, and then he was continually on the run and was finally captured in 1681 in the middle of July and was executed on the 27th. He was hanged, but his ministry was not over at that point because he had been ministering to so many of these people. One of those was James Renick, who would go on and continue to preach. Walter Smith was another man who he had had a great deal of influence in the life of. Walter Smith was hanged at the same time as Cargill. There were five men hanged there that day. Walter Smith was one of them. He seems to me to be the one that Cargill really gave his life to more than any other. But just a few observations about Cargill and his ministry. He knew what his calling was. God had given him that calling, and that calling was to preach the word. And he lived faithfully to that calling all of his days. Another thing that he's really noted for, and I noticed this in all of the books that I read about him, was the incredible combination of tenderness and zeal that he had. Cameron, there was probably no one more zealous than Cameron, but Cameron was kind of a young buck and was perhaps just not as experienced and didn't maybe have the tenderness that the elder Cargill did. Cargill had had many years of getting to know and love people in his congregations, and he did stand firm for the truth. He had that zeal, but he also had that tenderness and love for people. And I don't mean to in any way put Cameron down, but that was just one thing that Cargill really demonstrated, was that tenderness and zeal. Another thing that he's really noted for that I really liked is the length of his sermons, and I don't know what that's compared to, but it really shows his heart, I think. He said, he had someone ask him, he said, "It's so long between meals, and we are all in a starving condition. It is good, sweet, and wholesome which you deliver. But why do you straiten us for so much shortness?" To which Cargill replied, "Ever since I have bowed the knee in good earnest to pray, I never dared pray or preach with my gifts. And where my heart is not affected and comes not up with my mouth, I always thought it time for me to quit it. What comes not from my heart, I have little hope that it will go to the heart of others." Here was a man who was so in touch with God and with his word that he knew when God's word stopped and when his own words began, and he knew that that was the point to stop preaching. And that's the wonderful thing that that flock was fed. And the thing that I guess has made such an impact on my life through all of this is just doing a little family research. It was just over 3 months later, October 7th, that the first member of the Ferris family who had become a Christian was martyred. He had come to Christ 4 years previous to that and at the communion at Iron Gray in 78. He had became committed to the covenanted cause, and I have no doubt but that he sat under Cargill's preaching because he was right there in that same area. And when he was martyred, it was James Rennick who buried him. And God has been faithful through the ages. That man whose name was David was faithful to teach his son David, who was faithful to teach his son David, who taught his son James, who taught his son James, who taught his son Isaiah, who taught his son Henry, who taught his son Paul, who taught his son David, who has taught and still is teaching his son James. And so, just to kind of continue this, it started with Martin Luther, and I'm not sure who it was there between Knox and Rutherford, but God has continued to use that kind of relationship, and it may not have always been exactly the kind of relationship that Paul and Timothy had, but just to see how God works through the ages. And, you know, it's a pointless illustration if it stops with you and me, because men like Donald Cargill have had an impact on every single person in this room. But if it stops there, then it really hasn't done much in our lives. We need to be looking for who that faithful man is and who that Mr. Others also. And I think that's the kind of thing that Donald Cargill really desired to see in the lives of the people who he was preaching to, and that we should desire in our own lives too.
Thank you, James. Who's next on this? I've just been reading this afternoon about James Rennick. Who's next?
Dan.
Thank you. I've never seen anybody do that before, but thank you for that. So it brings right down to today. Rennick was there the day they hashed and hagged
Cargill and his friends. And he went back and picked them up, their bodies, and buried them and took the heads and the hands off the posts that had been stuck and buried them. And Rennick never got over that. And it had quite a little impact.
Okay, Joel Rich Zwingli was born in 1484 in Switzerland. His family was a large one. I found up to 9 children. The family was closely associated with the church. He had 2 brothers that were monks, and 2 of his sisters were nuns. His family was above average economically because of his ties with his church. And at the age of 5, he was sent to live with his uncle Bartholomew to get his education. I found that similar to what happened with Calvin. At the age of 14, he was sent to Paris to study with his, or not study, to live with his cousin. Zwingli diligently studied the Bible when he was at college or the university which he studied at. He was a person who enjoyed study and research. His main thing that he studied was Latin. Worked was that he believed that the Bible was the way he would go through the Reformation. He wasn't wanting to rush a Reformation, but he realized that from the studies of the Bible that there was a need for one. A position opened up in Zurich, where he ended up doing the greater part of his ministry. The previous priest at that church was Eric Batman. He had been promoted to the position of canon. He was invited to come to preach at Zurich in 1519. He agreed to the position on the condition that he would be free to teach the pure gospel of Jesus Christ, and he firmly believed that this was what would bring about a Reformation. The people in Zurich came to his sermons with great enthusiasm. As one man put it, such preaching we greatly need. He tells us the way to salvation. Zwingli first preached on the book of Matthew and then went on to preach the book of Acts. He followed this by the epistles to Timothy, and in doing this he unfolded the basic story of Christianity from Jesus' day to that of Paul's successor. The plague, which was common in those days, struck Zurich, and it was extremely severe. Zwingli comforted the sick and the dying, and he was struck with a plague himself and miraculously recovered. His break with the church was similar to that of Luther's. A colleague of Tetzel's, Bernardin Sampson, was selling indulgences in Switzerland. Zwingli raised a protest. The clash that followed was not as great, because Zwingli was not as forceful and he didn't make such as big of a deal as Luther did. And Samson was not as forceful in the way he was selling his indulgences. Luther and Zwingli were much alike, but they did differ on the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. There was the Conference of Marburg, where a man named Philip Landgrave of Hesse desired that they be brought together and so they could agree on their differences. But the conference was not to happen, and it saddened Zwingli, and he said with tears in his eyes, "On earth, with whom I'd rather be in harmony than with the Wittenbergers." Those were the followers of Luther. Luther said of Zwingli that you have a different spirit. Both men stood firmly to their convictions, and not long after this, the Swiss formed a new religious organization. They called it the Reformed Church. This is in great distinction with what is called the Lutheran Church today. Zwingli, in 1519, Zwingli was invited to become a preacher. Zwingli was a true shepherd of his flock. It was shown when the plague struck Zurich. The Reformation made great progress in Switzerland because it was divided into different cantons. A canton was a small city-state such as Zurich or Geneva, Bern. There were many different ones. Either the canton would accept the Reformation church or it didn't. This church, the cantons that didn't accept the Reformation formed an alliance with Austria, Catholic Austria, and this made Zwingli furious. He was a very patriotic person, loved his country. Four of the Protestant cantons took up arms, and it appeared that the Reformation would gain an important victory for their cause. The Catholics realized this and asserted that the Protestants who lived in the Catholic cantons would be given toleration, and the league with Austria was nullified. The Catholics did not stay true to their promise. They continued to persecute and murder Protestants. A civil war broke out, and the Catholics soon had an army of 8,000 men. They invaded the canton of Zurich. This is where Zwingli was. And the Zwinglians raised a small army of 2,700 men. Zwingli joined the force as a chaplain. And in 1532, a battle was fought, and Zwingli was injured in the leg by a spear. It was an unfortunate battle for the Protestants. Over 500 men were killed, and for Zwingli, this was, in his family, almost as a disaster. He had a brother-in-law, stepson, and a son-in-law that were all killed. See, Zwingli, as I studied Zwingli's life, I realized that he had a difficult decision to try to follow both Christ and his country. His family was closely connected with the church, and to break with the church must have been difficult for him. He was readily served the sick and the dying, because he felt that his duty as a pastor of the church was to serve them. Zwingli was the person that brought the Reformation to Switzerland to start with, and it made way for people such as Calvin and William Farel to bring the Reformation to the rest of Switzerland. Are there any questions?
You point to Bullinger here as being his Timothy?
Yeah.
At the very end there?
Is there anything, any other questions?
You have done what he learned to do, to present his thoughts and his ideas in an orderly manner, both by writing and orally.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. You've done that, and we're just thank you very much for that. I want each of you also to have a copy of the report that Elizabeth has prepared. Where is that? Is that here available, Elizabeth, please? Could you, Tom, help to pass that out? And Tom, yes?
Just waiting for a question in your lecture.
I want to make sure that we get a little bit of this tape in, just in finishing. Where's Michael? He's out with the tape right now.
I want to make sure we get a little bit of time for this tape. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We must have a couple of announcements here, too. There have been over 100 books. Last year, there were 100 missing from the library. This year, there are over 200 books missing in the library upstairs. Most of those books are Reformation church history books. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands of how many of you have taken out books without checking them out. But it's obvious to me that this class must have been involved in that in some way or another. The church history magazine books or magazines are almost all gone. And I really do want to scold you a minute on that, because being a scholar, and that's what I want every one of you to be, you treat books carefully, and that means checking them out. And there are over 100 of those Reformation history books that are missing. Some of them can be replaced, but not all. And so if you have any of those, please get those back. It's not good scholarship, and it's not right for other people. And if you know of anybody else who has some, why, please have them get those back there. This is a very, very serious thing. Now there's some announcements we also need to make about Scotland.
All of you should have received a reminder in the mail that the final payments are due this Monday. And so you can either give that to me tonight or on Sunday, or have it to me in the mail by Monday. And then secondly, Pastor Quigley has mailed the second book that is required for all of us to read. And if you could come up after the class, I have your names on the books. And you can pick those up along with a schedule, a day-by-day, hour-by-hour schedule. And finally, there is a preparation meeting on the 27th, which it would be good if every person that is going could be there if possible. That will be at 7 p.m. here in this room. And that's it. We also have your final exams after the class is over. Don't leave without them, please.
Now, these will be for every person who's going to Scotland?
Yes.
Is that right?
Right. There's no extras.
There'll just be enough for those going. So please get your copy if you're one of those going. And the inaugural study course is a sellout. That is, the whole place is full. So look forward to a good time. And those of you who can't go this year, look forward to another year. And plan for it. It will be a blessing to you. We'll bring back report, but there's no substitute for actually being there. So plan for that. We also have up here, this is a pretty good place to get some of the old books reprinted. And they're photographed, they're not printed, they're photographs. And so they're much less expensive than the old originals. But there's enough of these for everyone?
Yes, everyone can have one.
There's enough of these for everyone. So if you're interested in buying books at a reduced rate, and they have a spiral binding, and so it's terribly hard to put them into your shelf and keep them with other books. But the words, I mean, the thought, the content's there. So you can get those and mark them up and use them that way. Now, I do want you to hear some more of this segment from Beth's tape. Can we roll that, please? Michael, can you hear me? I think yes.
Thank you. McClellan and the three friends who were in Dalry, just a small town in the southwest corner of Scotland in the middle of November 1666, wondered what to do, where they should go. One of them had shot and wounded one of the four soldiers they had just captured. Word spread quickly, and the next morning, seven or eight others joined them. They decided to head down to Dumfries. Dumfries was more than 100 miles south of Dalry. In those days, they didn't have cars or buses or trains or airplanes. Those who were fortunate and well off had the luxury of a horse, but most went by foot. As they went, these dozen Covenanters encountered a dozen soldiers and captured them. But they put up a fight, and another shot rang out, and one of the soldiers was killed. They took the road south that followed the course of the River Nith. They would have passed through Kilmarnock, Cumnock, Newcumnock, and Sankar. These names would become famous in the years to come in the story of the Covenanters. It was a couple of days before they reached Dumfries, and in that time they were joined by John Nielsen of Corsock, who came with 50 horsemen and 200 foot soldiers. When the ministers had been put out in 1662, Mr. Nielsen had taken one of the ministers in, Gabriel Semple. Now, Reverend Semple continued to preach in Corsock Castle. People flocked to hear him until it became too crowded for them all, so they moved to the garden, then to the open field, the first field conventicle. The local curate turned him in. Nielsen was fined and had soldiers quartered on him, and the soldiers staying at his home nearly ruined him financially. Small wonder he was eager to be a part of the growing band of men. 100 years later, it was written into the Bill of Rights in the American Constitution that a government cannot quarter troops like that in civilian homes. When they arrived in Dumfries, they surprised and captured Sir James Turner and his whole garrison of soldiers. Turner had been sent to Dumfriesshire in the spring of that year to collect fines for non-attendance at the kirk. And he was good at it. He did so ruthlessly. He collected £41,000. And that was just in the region of Galloway, and another nearly £10,000 in Nithsdale, the Nith River Valley. Plus, his troops treated the inhabitants as though they were in enemy territory. They meted out sickening cruelty and injustice to ordinary citizens, as we have already seen in Dalry. No wonder the population grew rebellious. Before they left Dumfries, the Covenanters gathered at the Market Cross and drank the king's health. The Covenanters were very loyal to the king. You'd be surprised after seeing what the king was doing to them. But these men were not rebelling against the king himself. They didn't agree with what he was asking them to do, which they found contrary to the scriptures. The Covenanters had tried every avenue they knew to appeal against these things, but it fell on deaf ears. Even so, they were remembering the king before they left Dumfries that day. Now they headed up to Ayr, 55 miles up on the western coast of Scotland. They'd have to go back up the same river valley they'd come down just a few days ago. By now, it was Wednesday, the 21st of November, just over a week since the incident at Dalry. They met some others at the Brigadoon in Ayr. This bridge was made famous a century later by the Scots poet Robert Burns. Just now, it was an ordinary bridge over the Doon River. Near there at Arngrey, quite an army was beginning to form. Two of the volunteers have just met. "Hello, Jimmy. I wondered if I'd be seeing you here. Hello, Rab. Aye, I heard about that business in Dalry, and there's a few of us here. See yonder, That's our Willie. I'll let him bring our best side. It's all we had. You can see yourself, most of us got not much by way of weapons, just mostly what we had for work in the fields and that. But it's good to see him has got horses with pistols or swords. There's quite a number of them. Let's see who's here. Look, Jimmy, there's Captain Arnott with men from Mucklin, and Lockhart with men from Carlow. Oh, and Major Lermont with a party for Galston. Well, you look at that. It's Captain John Payton with men from Laddon and Finnick. Oh, you think? Has he brought his sword? That one, you can. Oh, aye. Do you know who's in charge of us all? Oh, aye, Lieutenant Colonel James Wallace. He's a good leader. There's ministers here, too. I saw Reverend John Welsh a wee while ago. Was he the one related to John Knox? He's his grandson. What they didn't know then was Welsh would be the one to persuade Richard Cameron to go into the ministry. Richie Cameron plays another major part of the Covenanter story, but not today. Hey, Rob, did you see Reverend William Veatch? He's here as well. Also, what they didn't know was that 10 years later, Mr. Veatch held conventicles right on the moorland belonging to Lauderdale, the Commissioner of Scotland. The very same day, Mr. Lauderdale passed an act in government charging a £50 fine to landowners for allowing conventicles to be held on their land. Mr. Veatch thought it fitting Mr. Lauderdale should be the first to pay that fine. There were 4,000 at that conventicle. He held several more there after that. Jimmy, I ken Reverend Hugh McHale is here, but he doesn't look awfully good. In fact, he had to leave the troops after a few days due to illness, but was later captured, tried, tortured, and hanged because he had been with them. He was only 26 years old. Right, Rab. Looks like we're setting off now. They're heading up east, towards Edinburgh way. This should be interesting. I've never been that far away from home before. Word came that Sir Thomas Dalyell was at Glasgow, not far to the north of them. He'd been sent to suppress conventicles. Tam Dalyell, his name looks like Dalziel, was one of the two most feared of the oppressors of the Covenanters, the other being John Graham of Claverhouse. Dalyell was a fanatical royalist, faithful to the crown, with a wild look because he never cut his beard after the beheading of King Charles I. He never wore boots, and he learned his very cruel ways from fighting in barbaric Russia and put them to use on the God-fearing citizens of Scotland. There was good reason to stay away from him. The army marched 12 miles east through Ochiltree and a few more miles to Cumnock. They'd been marching easily over the last couple of days, and by Friday night they'd marched 12 miles, arriving at Muirkirk at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. It had been violently raining. Rab was alongside Jimmy. I'm fair drookit for this rain, Jimmy, and so web it out I couldn't take another step. I'm pecking a bit, too. I'll just sit aside you a moment and get me breath back. Oh. Wasn't it kind of the minister here to open the kirk for us? It'd be nice to find a dry place to sleep. I'll miss my own bed, but it's good to be away for the rain. Say, Rab, did you catch that news about the other reinforcements? Oh, the ones with John Ross. Aye, they never got to us. Dalyell captured them already. That was a blow, I'll tell you. I saw John Welsh speaking earnestly to Sir James Turner. Aye, Jimmy. I was close enough to make out what he was saying. He's been trying to get him to save his soul and repent. He's really been at him with it until, would you credit it, that man has a sense of humor in his black heart. He finally stopped Mr. Welsh and looked him straight in the eye and said these exact words. It would be hard to turn a turner. The next morning was Saturday, November 24. News came that D.L. was now at Straven, not 20 miles due north of them. This was worrying. Yet word of 300 reinforcements on the way was an encouragement. They marched 12 miles to Douglas. The terrain they have been going through is not a nice, even road down a flat, open plain. The countryside in southern Scotland is not at all flat. The horizon is obscured most of the time by the rise and fall of the ground. It's a little like a very rumpled bedspread. Some areas are more hilly than others, but it seems the countryside is always going either up or down. Fortunately, on the whole, the hills are broad and rounded, though it gets steeper and more rugged in the west. North of Glasgow is the most rugged part, where the beauty of the country is at its best, with the hills surrounding picturesque lochs. Even so, there are few forests, and the rounded hills in the southern uplands of the south part of Scotland are covered in grasses or heather, with whin bushes along some of the valleys. In the spring, the yellow of the whin mixes with the daffodils, welcoming the new season. Then later in the summer, the heather blooms, causing whole hillsides to take on a beautiful purple hue. The heather is a very woody plant, which can bloom when only as tall as your ankle, or it might grow to waist high, blanketing acres of open hillside, which proved useful as cover to hide many a covenanter. So the Covenanters have not had an easy time of it. To add to their discomfort, however, they were getting torrential rain. Remember, it was late November as well. On Sabbath, they marched another 7-8 miles to Lesmahago. There they expected reinforcements, and they joined them. However, the 300 turned out to be only 50. The motley bunch stopped and did some military training and practice. They must have shaped up pretty well in a short time, for their prisoner, Sir Turner, even complimented them. Later in the day, they marched 6 miles to Lanark, where Alexander Peden left them. The minister, Sandy Peden, was almost a legendary figure in those years, and it may be he could foresee the danger and realized God wanted him elsewhere just now. This is where a dispute arose, whether to stand and fight now, or cross the Clyde River at Lanark and head to Edinburgh. The river was flooded due to the heavy rains, and the little ferry boat was broken. So this could be a natural barrier against the enemy. Then word came from Sir James Stuart in Edinburgh that he could provide more men and necessities there. The decision was made to cross the river. This disagreement caused many to withdraw from the army, and their numbers, which may have been up to 1,500, 2,000, dwindled to less than 1,000 men, 440 horsemen with swords and pistols, 500 or more footmen with scythes and pitchforks. Next morning, Monday, November 26, William Guthrie from Finnick, one of the outed ministers, preached to the troops, and then he tendered the covenants. The people swore to every article in great earnestness and devotion, and they remembered their object in raising arms, the redress of grievances. After that, they marched on to Bathgate, 20 miles away, the last 7 or 8, in the dark. The royal troops had appeared right before dark, but then drew back. Recruits were deserting along the way, and no wonder. There were no paved roads, so the pouring rain caused the ruts in the dirt track to run with mud. Little burns and streams were turned to rivers, making it even harder to cross them. There wouldn't be many bridges. They were all soaked to the skin, though thankfully they'd be wearing woolen clothes, which would still keep them warm even when wet. The ground rose in elevation the closer they got to Bathgate. As they neared it, the rain turned to sleet, stinging their faces with every blast of the freezing wind. And finally, the sleet turned to snow. By now it was midnight, and they wanted to stop, even in the open. But troops were sighted, so they had to keep going in that bad weather. As daylight appeared, they arrived at Newbridge. It was Tuesday, November 27. They were only about 10 miles from Edinburgh and heading straight in from the west. They would have pressed on, but a false alarm came that the enemy might occupy the bridge ahead. So they changed direction and circled round to Collinton on the south side of Edinburgh. From there they could easily see the extinct volcano standing in the centre of Edinburgh. It's called Arthur's Seat and looks like a headless camel. They were now about 800 or 900 men. They wanted a safe place to camp, so they marched round to the east side of the ridge of hills running south from just outside Edinburgh. These were the Pentland Hills, and they halted on a grassy meadow where the drovers often rested their cattle while on their way to the cattle market in Edinburgh. One of the Pentland Hills rose behind gently but precipitously. The patch of green itself sloped gently down to the plain, affording them good visibility to the front and protection from the back. The camping spot was called Rolyon Green. The weather was cold, but the men had the night to get some rest as best they could, wondering what awaited them the next day.
Is there an urgent question that someone has? Yes, Tom.
I have two questions. First of all, during the exercise, during the fence, the admonition period, were the speakers removed for some discussion beforehand and then they were brought in, or?
By removed, they just stepped down from the from wherever they were. They weren't taken out of the room or anything.
Okay. The next question I have, I see a pattern repeated a number of times where people seem to do much better than the ministers. I'm thinking of the time before Macmillan got in. I'm thinking of the time where there were maybe only Donald Cartier and one or two others in the conventicles, and when the indulgences were granted. I'm wondering, what is the cause of this? Do the authorities come and wipe the ball out? Or is there some particular temptation to which the ministers are particularly prone that we need to look out for? Any observations?
Yes. I think the ministers, by and large, have a sense of love and of concern And sometimes that love and concern takes them beyond where the Lord wants them to go in terms of helping people to help themselves. They want to do more for people in explaining the Word, and they're equipped to do that. I just read this afternoon how Rennick's examination in Holland for ordination was a four-hour oral examination over the coursework that he had completed there in Holland. The society sent him to Holland to get the training that they couldn't give him and to be ordained because Cargill had just been killed. And there wasn't anyone there, any other minister who could be involved in his ordination. So they sent him, they raised the money and sent him over to Holland, and he came back teaching. Now, he did not teach in such a way as to come between the people and the Word. His teaching stimulated them to do more. But the temptation always is for a minister to begin explaining and then not give time for feedback. And especially if a man loves his flock, he will want to do more teaching than what can be absorbed. I've facetiously said, and I emphasize it is facetiously, that the church was never more healthy than when all the ministers were shot off. That's a facetious statement, but my purpose in saying that is so that people will recognize the responsibility that they have for learning and growing, whether they're ministers or not, and then getting what help they can from the ministers who have been taught to understand the Scriptures and to exposit the Scriptures and to relate people to the Scriptures. But when we begin doing it for people instead of to help people to do it, then we've skipped something. And it's a pretty serious something that we skip. People no longer feel responsibility for reading and studying, applying the Word themselves. And it's easily stepped into because if you have a pastor whose heart does not love people, then you're in trouble. The minute he loves people, then he can begin trying to do things for them that they ought to be doing for themselves. Does that help?
Okay, I can see. You've explained in many ways the strength of the people. But what is the weakness of the ministers? Or were they simply all executed by the authorities? Why, like in the Revolution Settlement, okay? The ministers all went erastian, okay? What was their problem compared with the people? What was their particular temptation that seemed to... I mean, I'm just looking at it from a statistical standpoint. A great number seemed to fail somewhere. Where was that somewhere?
The somewhere was at that point where they were pressured to join with the new church, the Revolution Settlement Church, for the purpose of changing it. They didn't just forget the past. They went into it with the idea that they could change it after they got in there.
So was this an honest mistake as opposed to...
Yes, for the most part. Everybody was tired fighting. And if you had a family of four or five children and you'd been locked out of the church and you had a parish full of people here who were interested in learning the Word for the sake of your family and for the sake of the church, you would... The parish, that is, the people in the parish, you would probably say, well, there's more to be gained by going back in and teaching the Word than by staying back out and contesting this. And that was a serious thing. James?
Is that what the Church of Scotland then flows out of?
That was the church, the Revolution Settlement established the Church of Scotland.
Which continues even today.
Yes, yes, uh-huh. Yes, Carol?
Society, why did they wait 17 years? Could they have not found the ordained ministers sufficient?
They couldn't find any.
Okay, so they felt these ordained ministers had left the teaching that they believed in. So they said, you can't marry us. You can't baptize us. You're not good enough.
That's right. Well,
where did John McMillan arise from?
John McMillan had protested the Revolution Settlement. And then as time went along, he protested it more and more. and he in his own presbytery, in his own congregation, he kept bringing up letters of protest. And at the same time, when he was the pastor there, and that's not far from Wishaw, where Andrew Quigley is pastor, and David Fallows, his brother-in-law. But close to that, Balmahie, where McMillan was pastor, he was ministering to his own congregation and arguing with the presbytery and the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland and giving them papers about why they were wrong and why they needed to become right. And at the same time, he was ministering the word to people in the societies, although he was not yet accepted by them. They would accept his ministry of the word, but they wouldn't accept him in his official capacity until they recognized in his letters of dissent and his protestations the same position that they had. Even then, they examined him very, very carefully concerning his attitude towards the covenants. Church of Scotland, as newly established, had said, we'll just forget about the covenants. And Macmillan said, those covenants are important. And they're important enough that I will have to leave the Church of Scotland. And so he did, and at that point the societies recognized that he was one of them.
So what proportion of the population were remaining in society, though, and how many of the Church of Scotland sit together?
Well, that's the point where there's no very good statistics. I think there were thousands and thousands of people. Because the way the Reformed Church grew so rapidly, I mean, they were growing more rapidly in terms of new presbyteries than we are growing in this Indiana presbytery in terms of new congregations. And as I look at the numbers of people who signed requests, who signed calls, as another man would become licensed and qualified and available, a group of societies over here would call him. And then the United Societies would say, what can you provide for him? Can you provide for him? And where would he be centered? When there were just two, they divided the whole group up into a northern and a southern. But then when there were three, they began dividing into various groups. And later on, when there were four, William Symington was ordained and installed as pastor of the Sonora congregation, cleared down in the southwest corner, as far down southwest corner as you can get in Scotland, just across from Ireland. And on the day of his ordination, there were, I think they said something like 12,000 people who were there. Well, as I looked at the statistical record, that's more than what that whole part of the county had as population. It wasn't heavily populated in those days. And when they could draw that many people, and in the conventicles, in the communion services, and they had outside communion services, there would be thousands of people to those communion services. And it's not surprising to me that the historians of the Church of Scotland are not interested in putting the number up very far. But I think it was a good proportion of the total population of Scotland that were deeply involved in these United Societies of Southwest Scotland. I'm afraid to say 25% or 50% or something like that, but in that one case in the Shire, Wigtonshire, not Wigtonshire, but the other Shire down there. Yes, it was Wigtonshire. In that shire, there were far more people who had come in than there were citizens of the whole county. And what I did was get the statistical records of that county for that period of time and then compared them with the reports of that the newspaper was making of the numbers of people who were there at the time of his ordination installation. And the service went on for a couple of 3 days. They'd come in all kinds of ways and camp there. Yes?
Okay, Mr. Blair, this meeting for Scotland is what day?
The 27th, the evening, that's a Wednesday night, the evening of the 27th, for those of you who are going to Scotland. Yes?
That's what the community has to be about.
Yes. Let me give you copies of what I've written. This is a copy of an article that I published a number of years ago on the subject of what we were dealing with this evening in the lecture. Thank you for reminding me that, God. And I would very much appreciate if you would pray for me in the preparation of these lectures for Scotland, because I'll be speaking the majority of those who are there. How many are from America?
About 50
from America. There will be some from Ireland, a very few from Scotland. But I'm going to have to be careful about what I say and how I say it. And yet I want these to be a contribution to the study, not just a rehearsal of other research, other books that they could read and get these facts. And the Lord is opening things for me on that. William Symington, whose life and theology I was researching and working, was quite a historian, a church historian. Most people don't recognize him. They recognize him as a systematic theologian, but they don't recognize that he was a historian. And yet he was traveling and working with the research of these very periods that we're talking about down in southwestern Scotland. And his family lived at Tinto, which is within 5 or 6 miles of the place where we'll be living in Bigger. They were very active during these very years of persecution. Did you have something, Elizabeth?
What happened to the societies then in the 1800s and then the 1900s? What kind of town meetings now, where people get together, or how is it?
No, they continued on in the churches, and when I was over there first in 1953 and 54 and 55, there were congregations that still remembered the managers. And these were vestiges of the societies. And Andrew Quigley tells me that he remembers when there were societies. And in Ireland, they also had those societies. I think that we're seeing the same kind of thing beginning to develop. And I guess I pray that it's just the beginning of it in the elders' fellowship meetings here in this congregation and in those age-integrated meetings. Where the Bible schools in the morning involves dad and mother and the children as we sit around together and do those ABC studies. Now, the words ABC, I can't find that any place in Reformation history. But the kind of study that these ABC studies are, this is one reason why back when we first came here, I began asking that we would have this kind of study. Because it is a Reformation-type study. John Knox said the face of the Kirk must be constantly reforming. I don't think it can be unless the individual members and families in the congregation are doing this kind of study. But I do find evidence in medieval years as well as in early church years that this kind of study was going on. I'm very much encouraged by seeing Knox and Beitzer and Calvin and all these other men interpret 1 Corinthians 14 in this way. They were concerned about speaking in tongues and excesses. They were concerned about that. But they weren't so focused on that as being the main teaching in this chapter that they missed the other thing, which I think is far more important than that. There is a type of meaning that God is teaching us about in that chapter. If we'll only see it and then practice it, then we have a very valuable thing that's been so valuable in history. All right, let's bow our hearts, and I thank you for the privilege of teaching through this past class, and this will be the last time I see you. In the fall of the year, I want to go back and do some more work in terms of the Reformed Presbyterian Church and this period of church history, and you'll be getting a brochure on that a little bit later this summer. Father in heaven, thank you now for the way you've taught us through the Reformation on the continent, through the Reformation in England and in Scotland. Thank you now for bringing us up through this second Reformation, these years of killing and persecution. God bless us as you would prepare us for whatever it is you have ahead for us. Lord, thank you. for hearing about how Donald Cargill has passed that testimony on down from generation to generation to generation. And Ulrich Zwingli, as you used him there in Switzerland. Thank you, too, for this work that Elizabeth's given to us on Cameron. God, we thank you for these, and we pray that you would bless them in the study and in the lives of those who did these studies and in our lives as we read them and make them.